and welcome to this public hearing on the current and future wholesale electricity markets. My colleagues and I thank all of you for taking the time to travel to Harrisburg and spend this afternoon with us to discuss these important issues. We have agreed among ourselves that because we have a lot of questions, we are not going to take up time with introductory remarks. We may have a few at the end, but we are going to spend most of our part of this in questioning. So, Judge Gutierrez, will you please conduct the proceeding?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For those of you who don't already know me, my name is Bruce.
Apparently in the back, they can't hear you.
All right. I'm accustomed to sitting at the bench up there and shouting, so if this works, it'll work. All right. I was asking you all to turn your cell phones off. You know, if you have trouble with that, I'm sure there are a couple hundred authorities in the audience who can help you. As you may or may not know, our speakers are limited to a maximum 15-minute presentation. I will be assisted by that lovely electronic light bar that's sitting on the table. There'll be a green light up there for a while, and then at some point it'll flash yellow and then red. And I'll try to gently remind the speakers that they have about 1 minute to go. All of the speakers have submitted written statements, and they are available on tables over there. If you, by chance, didn't get a copy, they're also posted on our website, and you can find those by going to the website and selecting electricity and then wholesale energy markets. I will ask that there's one gentleman here, and I've lost track who. Oh, Mr. Edwards has the PowerPoint demonstration. That'll be right over here to my left and your right. And I will remind them that they all have microphones, and hopefully they work better than mine does. So just lean into the mic and talk. And the last rule I have on the list here is please do not discuss any active cases in front of the commission at this point. My rules are over, and I believe our first speaker is Mr. Ott, isn't he?
Yes.
Thank you.
I can proceed?
Yes, please do.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Colley, Vice Chairman Christie, and other commissioners. Thanks for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. My name is Andrew Ott. I'm the Senior Vice President of Markets at PJM. And my goal today is to discuss how PJM deploys its competitive wholesale market to accomplish a core mission, which is to maintain electric system reliability for customers in Pennsylvania and throughout the region we serve. I, too, am concerned about the impact of price increases on consumers. I want to explain how the rising wholesale electricity prices are being caused by market fundamentals, including the rise in prices of fuel. And they're not caused by the fact that the market's dysfunctional or incapable of providing reasonable price levels. I'll also discuss what's currently being done by PJM to mitigate increase in wholesale electricity costs, as well as what can be more can be done to put downward pressure on price. PJM is a regional transmission organization. As you know, there are 7 ISOs and RTOs throughout the country that cover approximately two-thirds of the area in the U.S. PJM is responsible for coordinating the electric grid and running the power market across 13 states and Washington, D.C., including most of of Pennsylvania's 12 million residents. As an RTO, we do not own transmission or generation facilities. We don't generate electricity. We don't buy energy for resale. We don't have retail customers, and we don't profit from the markets we operate. We essentially are the independent grid operator who provide the capability for consumers to gain access to the large regional wholesale market, which provides a large portfolio of generation resources for them to choose from. Market participants also benefit from this large scale of the regional market because it's competitive. As the independent system operator, PJM is free from undue influence by market participants. And we have the PJM market monitor, who you heard from today, who is our market watchdog to ensure the market's competitive. To keep the lights on, PJM must perform real-time balancing of the electric grid every second of every minute of every day. While we do this, we have to respect the transmission constraints and other constraints of the electric power grid, being prepared for loss of generation or any other contingency-type event. The wholesale pricing system, locational marginal pricing, ensures PJM is able to operate the grid within the constraints that exist on any given day. It's a critical element in operation of the grid. Provides price signals to maximize energy transfers for the benefit of all customers in the region. The LMP system essentially makes participants partners with PJM in maintaining grid reliability through price signals. And our goal is, again, to be certain to the extent possible within constraints that the least expensive set of generation resources is operating to serve the grid on any given hour of the day. I would like to turn now to talk a little bit about the PJM spot market. It is an open single clearing price auction. It plays a fundamental role in maintaining short-term reliability of the grid, but it also provides access to the power grid by all customers. It's, again, open access. I will note that every other ISO and RTO in the country is either using currently LMP system or is planning to implement it. Even California, who experienced significant problems with reliability and pricing back in 2000-2001, has abandoned their old system and is looking to implement the LMP system. The opponents of LMP state that it results in unjustly high wholesale prices due to unnecessary payments to generators, such as baseload coal plants. And you may have heard how the baseload coal plant is sometimes paid far above its bid because the natural gas plant sets the price. It's been stated this isn't fair and that generators should be paid only their bid price. That is a logical thought, but that type of system has been tried elsewhere. It creates a series of incentives that assume that a generator would bid its cost and be paid that cost, when in fact a pay-as-bid system would actually incent people to bid what they believe the power is worth, as opposed to what they believe the cost is. This results in generators guessing essentially what the market price would be. It would result in fluctuating bid patterns, and when you have generation changing its bid, it would actually change its method of operation and create some significant issues for reliability of operation because of the additional uncertainty that would be created.
Better.
We've also heard concerns about the profits of generators in addition to questions related to deregulation and how it was designed in Pennsylvania. PJM wasn't part of the deregulation process in Pennsylvania, and we really didn't have a direct involvement in that. But the ultimate question is, the wholesale market encompasses 13 states and the District of Columbia. If there is an issue with specific issues related to Pennsylvania and the issues of deregulation there, the question would be, is the best place to deal with that in the design of the wholesale market? And I think the answer would be no. The better place to deal with that would be directly through a situation that was unique to Pennsylvania. If I could turn now to discussion of the factors that impact rising wholesale prices. If you look at my testimony, page 4, I have a graphic that shows the impact of various types of fuels on electricity prices, and it helps explain which types of fuels drive the prices. I would also point you to a graphic on page 5 of my testimony that actually shows fuel indices. This is actually an index-type chart that shows the comparison of the PJM wholesale power price to the indices for fuel. One of the things I point out to you is if you look at the characteristic of each of those indices, the wholesale price most closely follows the price of coal, as you would expect, because coal is the preliminary driver of electricity prices in PJM footprint. I'd also point out the next page on page 6 of my testimony. If you look at recent trends of the electricity futures, you may have noticed over the past few months we've seen quite a significant shift in the cost of commodities. Primarily the fuel prices have dropped. If you look at my graphic, this essentially illustrates the quite dramatic effect that the drops in fuel prices have had on electricity future prices. So the news is not all bad. We are seeing actually a reversal in some of these costs. Obviously, as the independent grid operator, I watch the markets, as does the market monitor, to ensure that the markets are operating as expected. And I would expect that since you're seeing some of these commodity prices start to come down, if you have done any analysis to determine what the projected impact on rates would be, you may want to take into account the recent events, because I would think you would find a lower expectation based on the current conditions. And now I'd like to talk a little bit about the other influences that cause electricity prices to rise. We have a significant regulatory uncertainty approaching the electric industry and the environmental world. You have a general lack of new generation, new transmission investment over the past 20 years that obviously is going to need to be addressed. I think the significant uncertainty you see in the environmental regulation has caused a significant pause, if you will, in the investment in, for instance, coal-based power plants, because there's some significant uncertainty in how that will be addressed in the future. I turn now to tools. What can we do to control some of these rising costs that we're seeing? In addition, of course, to observing that some of the costs have been turning around lately. I think the first and foremost thing is hedging.
Mr. Ott,
excuse me?
One minute, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was seeing the light still green. essentially, the tools customers have is to hedge, to actually buy. This would be a great time to essentially purchase based on forward contracts, since the forward prices are coming down now. Another is demand response. Demand response is a significant tool that customers have to reduce their electric consumption and control price. The last issue is looking at energy efficiency and looking at smart meters and that type of infrastructure to help support the customers being able to express their desire based on the price they're willing to pay for electricity. With that, I'll defer the rest of my testimony. Look forward to your questions. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak in front of you today.
Mr. Chairman?
Judge, let's go in this order. The Vice Chairman, and then Commissioner Powelson, and then Commissioner Pitsengrilli, and then Commissioner Gardner, and then I'll go last.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you. Mr. Ott, thank you for being here today. We appreciate you making the trip up. And I know you've put a lot of time and effort into this, so thank you very much. I have a number of questions here, and as you can suspect, there's probably a lot of areas where we may have some levels of disagreement. Mm-hmm. But I thought I would try to work through some of these questions, if you don't mind.
Okay.
And I'll try to keep it in chronological order, your testimony. On page 1, in the first paragraph, you discuss that PJM's mission, its core mission, is to maintain the electric system reliability. And first, let me say I think that PJM does an excellent job of performing that task, and should be commended for that. The concern I have is, where does the concept of least cost planning come into play here? In terms of meeting the system reliability standards, as well as trying to do some strategic planning here to accommodate some good results for consumers at the end of the day.
The As far as the transmission planning process, we have a both a transmission planning process and, of course, a generation adequacy requirement. In the transmission planning process, PJM has a multi-year, 15-year planning process where we look into the future for the needs of the system and essentially analyze, based on the regional need, what the most economic, if you will, set of transmission upgrades to cover the future would be. Given a set of generation commitments, if you will, in the capacity market. So essentially what the transmission planning process does is looks at the anticipated load growth and looks at what the set of capacity resources declared in the capacity auctions, and then make sure the transmission system is adequate to cover that. There's also an economic planning process that looks at the amount of transmission congestion on the system relative to the cost of, for instance, an upgrade to alleviate that congestion, and goes through a series of steps to look at the economics, if you will, of transmission expansion.
Okay, how about on the generation side? Specifically, one of my concerns is that if you have a stack up of, say, 10 projects, and you have 9 projects that may not produce as desirable results for consumers, as, say, a 10th project, which may be, say, like a coal-fired power plant with a real low running cost, how do we ensure that we get some least cost application here, or is it just first come, first serve process?
Pardon me. You from a generation perspective, the generators will offer into the capacity market to be eligible to clear, and essentially we do that based on a least cost set of resources to satisfy the capacity needs. Now, as you know, generators depend on both capacity revenues and energy revenues when they're looking at their capacity offers. The capacity market actually does a generation revenue offset based on the energy and ancillary service markets. So when the generator offers into the capacity market, if it is a resource that would get significant revenue from the energy market, you would expect its capacity offers to be lower. But at the end of the day, we're not doing a least total production cost capacity acquisition.
Okay, so you just leave it up to the market to decide
exactly
who wants to make their pitch. Okay.
Exactly.
On the same page, your first paragraph, what's your definition of effective competition or a competitive market? We seem to have different definitions of what's a competitive market. I've read Joe's testimony, and he has a definition of competitive market. I was curious what your definition of what constitutes a competitive market.
Well, a competitive market, of course, is one where you have low barriers to entry. The characteristic of a competitive market is you have a low barrier to entry, and many participants can come in and compete within that market. Obviously, a competitive market results. In other words, if you're looking at the results of a market over time, you would expect that over time the generation offers. I think I agree with Joe to an extent. The generation offers, you can actually compare those to look at their markup versus their calculated marginal cost. And if you see those markups being relatively low, that's a competitive result. So it depends on whether you're talking about the characteristic of the market, meaning open sort of low barrier to entry, versus the actual result.
Okay. Would you agree with Dr. Bowring's conclusion that a competitive market has zero markup is infinitely competitive, but as you get into markups, then you have to start to analyze whether or not there are competitive markets existing?
Well, you can use the markup as a indicator, if you will. Obviously, it's not an absolute indicator, because I don't think the marginal cost calculation is perfect, because there is some inaccuracies in that based on opportunity costs and other things like that. But I think it is a good indicator. I don't know that you would say that you could calculate it down to the nearest decimal place.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, in this regard, one of the concerns I have is I understand when the three pivotal supplier test is applied to determine whether an area has market dominance or not, if it's determined that there is market dominance, then people are limited to, their generators are limited to cost plus 10%.
Correct.
As a measure of that's an effective or competitive price that consumers should pay. But what about all the other LMPs and the prices that are resulting from those particular clearing prices in different LMPs? Does anyone really take a look at the prices that the generators are receiving compared to their cost of producing the power to make a determination of whether or not we have a competitive market?
I think the determination of whether you have a competitive market is based on the offers that the generators are submitting and the fact that they are competing to provide the power needed either locationally or globally within the grid. So I do believe we are looking at, or Joe's looking at, that type of analysis to determine the competitive offers of the generators.
Okay. All right, thank you. Again, on page one here, it's the second paragraph in the middle, comment that the regional scope of the wholesale market provides benefits to consumers by providing access to a large portfolio of less expensive power resources. And this is where, maybe I have a Pennsylvania bent to me, but as I look at the statistics in Pennsylvania, I see that we have over 90% of our energy is derived from coal and nuclear facilities, and that we're exporting a significant amount of power outside of the state of Pennsylvania. And when I see the prices that are resulting on the LMPs, it's just hard for me to feel comforted that the Pennsylvania customers at the end of the day are getting the benefits of a competitive market, because I look at the markup of being significantly above the price of the coal and the nuclear facilities. So maybe you can help me understand if I'm missing anything here in this one.
The competitive market, you have a spot market, which is the PJM market. And the PJM market sets the price on a given five-minute period or hour or day, depending on which market you're in. But also, most consumers, most load-serving entities are going to buy the energy on a forward basis. They aren't going to buy, individually on a spot market. In fact, the majority of the load actually served is based on bilateral contracts. So the access to a diversity of supply in order to get your long-term power needs satisfied. You can have a portfolio approach, if you will, to serving to meeting your electricity demand. That's essentially what the wholesale market provides. The price. I'm sorry.
I got to move along pretty quickly here. On page three, on your first full paragraph, the implementation of ISOs and RTOs across the country. My understanding of looking at some of the studies out there is that the prices that are resulting from RTOs seem to be higher than the prices that are resulting from non-RTOs. And I thought that would be a fair question to throw on the table, again, if I'm missing something there as far as how to look at this issue.
Well, I think you have various types of studies that are out there. I think for every study you find that says the price increases are higher in RTO regions, there's another study that says that the price increases are not. I think if you look at the price increases we've seen over time, I think they're very closely correlated to fuel price increases. I think that you see the same thing in the non-RTO regions. I think, if you look at the recent, rate increases in Tennessee. My recollection is they saw three rate increases in the last year. And again, it's very consistent with what we're seeing in the PJM region.
Okay. On that page three, we have a discussion about the benefits of the single market clearing price versus the application of pay-as-you-bid approach.
Yes.
Are you familiar at all with Great Britain and how they, I understand that they dropped their single market clearing price, and I haven't followed the results of this, so I don't know exactly how it's worked, but I understand that Great Britain 4 or 5 years ago, got rid of the single market clearing price and replaced it with a pay-as-bid type of approach. And I was curious if you have any knowledge or experience with that.
Probably no direct knowledge or experience. My understanding, though, is they moved off of the pay-as-bid system to a clearing price either recently or very soon. So I don't want to bring myself forth as an expert on the UK system, though.
I mean, that's something we could have a
discussion.
But I think
there are some significant problems they'd identify with pay-as-bid.
Okay. On page 8... at the top of the page, there's a comment about the annual price of capacity in 2001 at $100.43 per megawatt per day.
Right.
Now, who received that that capacity payment at the end of the day?
Anyone who sold capacity in the auctions, any resource who sold capacity in the PJM auctions. There were annual, monthly, and daily auctions at that time. So anyone who would have sold capacity in those auctions would have received that price.
Okay, so if as an individual generator I sold my capacity into that market, I received that $100 per megawatt day, but if I did not bid into that market, I did not receive any payments?
Right.
Okay. And because as I understand RPM right now, people bid in and then everybody gets the price that's determined for that region. And as I look at this in 2001, was it a case where if you one bidder and one buyer of the power versus spreading out the capacity credit amongst all the generators?
Actually, I think they were very similar, although I may agree that the price formation within RPM includes all resources and all demand. Again, you know, it is not true that every generator who clears an RPM is seeing that clearing price because they have a bilateral contract, for instance, where essentially if you have demand on one side and supply on the other, again, just like energy, you don't see that market price. You actually see your bilateral contract price. So that's not dissimilar from you know, a what I'll call an incremental auction type approach. It just essentially sets the spot price index.
Okay. On page 8 again, this is regarding the results of the RPM process. And I'll just, you know, cut to the chase. It's we're short on time here.
Okay.
What I struggle to understand is, you know, what we really got for the I've heard numbers like $26 billion. I've heard numbers of $30 billion across the grid for the four-year RPM process. And when I look at what we got for that kind of money, it's just hard for me to come to the conclusion that consumers got a good deal here for that $30 billion. In other words, for $30 billion, we could have built 10,000 megawatts of brand-new baseload facilities in the ground and paid forever, but with $30 billion, it just seems like we got a four-year lease on some facilities. And I think that's my major concern with that auction, but to give you an opportunity to...
Well, again, if you quote a $30 billion number, you assume the price of capacity in the past was zero, because essentially that's the only way you calculate $30 billion. If you assume capacity had some cost in the past, and if you assume that's $100, for instance, you know, based on some of the historic results we saw, then the impact of RPM is more like $5 billion. And then I think that's very consistent with the investments you've seen. I think it's consistent with the investment in the existing plants that Dr. Bowering had quoted in his report about, you know, $5.1 billion of investment over those same period of time, and largely in existing coal plants. So I think, again, it really depends on what you use as your reference. If you would use a reference of zero, which I think is unrealistic, capacity simply wasn't zero in the past. It did have a cost, and that cost had ranged, you know, between $60 and $100 per megawatt year. Per megawatt per day.
Okay. I just have one more quick question here. On page 9, at the bottom there's a comment that existing generators invested $5.1 billion for environmental compliance and performance upgrades to allow 10,000 megawatts of existing resources to remain operational. Are you suggesting that but for the RPM upgrades, that these upgrades to these power plants would have never have happened?
I'm suggesting, I think RPM was a critical piece. I think what the consultant, the Brattle study, had found was, again, these resources that, you know, needed to do this investment. I think there was a high degree of likelihood they could not have done that investment had RPM not been in place.
Okay. That's, I could go on forever, but we only have so much time today. Thank you very much. I appreciate the answers.
Commissioner Paulson.
Thank you. In the interest of hopefully getting to see the first pitch thrown out tonight, I'll be brief. Annie, thank you for taking the time out to be with us, and I commend the management team from PJM for really your steadfast efforts, not only in working with our staff, but the legislature on the passage of House Bill 2200, along with the DEP and the governor's office. So we appreciate the work that you do. One of the things that my colleague mentioned, and I share this with you because it doesn't grab headlines in the Harrisburg Patriot or the Philadelphia Inquirer, but post-1996, we've created 8,000 megawatts of new power by non-incumbent generators here in the PJM footprint, and actually Pennsylvania, excuse me. We're a net exporter of power, and I also recognize we have some serious transmission constraints here in the Commonwealth. If I were to ask you, keeping in mind with the passage of House Bill 2200 and prior to that, the AEPS requirements, your views from a public policy and an economic perspective of what Pennsylvania is doing right and what we're not doing right.
I think the Pennsylvania is doing right. I think the concept of so some of the policies are coming out in the House Bill 2200. Looking at supporting demand response, supporting energy efficiency. I think as we all look forward, the entire industry looks forward to the future where we're going to have significant costs. I mean, if we have carbon legislation, greenhouse gas legislation, it's going to create tremendous pressure on price and hardship on consumers. So I think having the consumers armed with the ability to curtail either on a round-the-clock basis in energy efficiency or in demand response is critical. Setting up infrastructure, the metering infrastructure that can create a price responsive demand curve. When I dispatch, or not me personally, but we dispatch down at PJM, actually having a price responsive demand curve that could compete directly with the next generator in line would be a powerful, not only good for consumers, but great for system reliability. It'd give me a lot more flexibility. So I think that is critical. The environmental aspects of in other words, supporting renewables. The competitive wholesale market, obviously, as you know, supports renewables by providing a revenue stream to those and providing flexibility. So I think that's another great area. I think the what could be done better, for instance, I think is looking at, as we look forward to the future and the expiration of rate caps, I think there are certain tools that could be exercised. Portfolio management. What I'll call, if you look at some of the competitive auctions you've seen in retail, New Jersey is an excellent example. For instance, they have an auction that has implicit hedging where it occurs over a multi-year period, so you don't have any 1 year creating a large price excursion for consumers. Where you saw in contrast to Maryland, where they did all their procurement in 1 year, same year that Katrina hit, very bad result. In New Jersey, their same increase when Maryland had a 70% was only 30% because they were spread across multiple years. So that type of thing you could look at is portfolio management to help control price increases for consumers.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my question.
Commissioner Pitson-Gilley.
Thank you, Andy, for coming today and for your testimony. Just a quick question, if you could expand a bit on the demand response programs, how important you think they are to the region, and what is participation and what kind of obstacles are you encountering, and if you are, what can we do to remove those obstacles?
Okay, yeah, I think, again, demand response, if you look at the opportunity that's there as far as the ability to control future demand. We're actually looking at implementing energy efficiency in the capacity market for the next auction. If you get significant amounts of energy efficiency, it'll offset the need. We've already seen 2,000 megawatts of demand response come in our forward auction last year, which essentially is a substitute for two, large baseload plants. If you look at medium size, it's more like four. I expect this year to see that increase by 50%. So, again, with the types of support that demand response can provide, it'll put significant controls on the price. What PJM's trying to do as far as demand response, and I think would be helpful, is on a regional level, have more uniformity in the rules at a retail level, because the curtailment service providers who provide the capability for aggregation have to look at each set of rules across the various states in the region. So again, obviously the states can't have the same rules, I know that, but there could be some coordination. I think there is. We're working through MADRI efforts to try to do some coordination to lower the barriers to having those competitive load servers provide a service at lower cost. So I think that's the kind of thing that would help on a regional basis without, hopefully, with a minimum amount of expense. It's more coordination.
When you talk about regional states, are there any states that you think have the most efficient standards or regulations in place that should serve as a model?
At this point, again, from a retail auction perspective, I think New Jersey has done the best job as far as the state retail auction, because I think their retail auction is well designed. I think it's the best I've seen. As far as the demand response programs, I think the most proactive lately has been Maryland. And I think if you look at what Maryland has done over the past year or two, as far as supportive of demand response, I think it's tremendous. So I think those two states certainly are within the MADRI, the Mid-Atlantic Distributed Resource Group, which Pennsylvania belongs. I think that would be a helpful coordination.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner.
Sorry. Thank you, Andy, for your presentation, and thank you for your answers today. I have two quick questions, and again, it is around demand response. And my first question, which will then have a follow-on, is how much generation is controlled by PJM currently?
Capacity of generation is about 167,000 megawatts of capacity, generation capability.
Okay. And in that 167,000 megawatts, you currently have a little bit more than 2,000 megawatts of demand response.
The 2,000 megawatts of demand response was the capacity-based forward. We have about 6,000 megawatts of demand response total as far as short-term and long-term capacity-based. As far as economic demand response, that's probably more on the order of about 2,000.
Yeah. So I guess the question that I really want to ask is, could PJM be doing more to facilitate and promote demand response across is 13 PJM states, and why haven't you?
Yeah, and I think more could be done to facilitate demand response. I think, again, we have 13 states in the District of Columbia. In some states, it's actually illegal for demand response to participate in the wholesale market. There's a commission prohibition to it, or something like that. So in some parts of our footprint, there is no direct demand response in the program. I think in other parts of the footprint, there are states that are searching for ways to facilitate it better. In PJM, I have a demand response steering committee I've been running for about a year within our stakeholder process to try to lower barriers to demand response. I don't think we're there yet. I think I can do smart metering and some of the infrastructure things can help, but I can also streamline the wholesale rules, and I am actively trying to do that to get more demand response in. I had mentioned the energy efficiency rules. Up in New England, they had actually implemented energy efficiency in the capacity market last year. PJM has not done that yet. I'm actually having a vote on that within our stakeholder process within the next 2 months, and I plan to have that implemented by our next auction, which is in May. Okay. So we can do more, and we're trying to.
Okay. that's very encouraging. My second question is probably a little bit more pointed, because in page 4 of your testimony, and I'll just summarize, that you look at deregulation and some of the issues that are affecting Pennsylvania, and you say, at least in my interpretation, is, well, Pennsylvania, there might be a better venue or better ways, in fact, for you to look at how you treat wholesale electricity, because you don't want to do something in Pennsylvania that could have an effect on the other 13 states and the District of Columbia. Is that fair?
Actually, what I think I was trying to say there was that if you're looking to address a concern related to some issues with deregulation legacy within Pennsylvania, a more direct approach, instead of looking at the wholesale market design, which is a much broader, is to look at specific contractual issues within Pennsylvania. Again, balanced portfolio approach, some type of auction approach. I think that's a little more targeted than trying to look at a wholesale market design. That's what I meant to say.
Okay, thank you. My follow-on questions to that, because I'm sure it might be more than one, is would you be aware of how many PJM states actually now have cases pending before FERC regarding how the various markets within PJM are operating? The reason for that question is to suggest that it is not, Pennsylvania is not unique in its concern for how the wholesale markets are behaving. And if you could let me know.
Yeah, I think as far as the energy market, I don't know of any, but the capacity market, which is the RPM we had discussed, I think there are at least four states who had expressed concern, especially recently, over some of the RPM results in the past 4 years. So there's four I know of in the capacity world. I don't know of any specifically in the energy market.
Okay.
Thank you.
But would that suggest that there might be some bigger problem than just what we are talking about here in Pennsylvania?
I would suggest that we need to look more closely at the capacity market issue, and I think, in fact, we have going right now some discussions on the capacity market. There's a working group that I'm working with also, and through the organization of PJM states, on that issue. But again, to say that I don't think the capacity market issue itself is has spilled into the energy market as far as some of these cases you're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Judge, and Mr. Ott, welcome. First of all, it seems that merchant transmission projects seeking to move up in the queue to relieve transmission constraints, and by what I mean transmission or merchant transmission projects are those not by the utility but by those willing to bear the risk themselves. These merchant transmission projects seem to be subject to vigorous market benefit tests, which reliability projects are not subject to. No cost-benefit analysis tests for reliability projects, but vigorous cost-benefit or market benefit analyses for merchant projects. Is there any justification for such disparate treatment?
Essentially, if you have a transmission project that needs to be implemented, there's two triggers. One could be you need to resolve a reliability problem to meet the reliability criteria, in which case then the planning department would look at the least cost transmission solution to cover that.
Would you move just a little closer to the mic? We can't hear you as well up here as those behind you can hear you.
I'm sorry. For a reliability project, in other words, there's a triggering event that causes a transmission upgrade. One is a reliability violation that needs to be corrected. That's a trigger. There's another trigger that is where reliability is not, criteria is not violated, but there's an economic benefit to a specific upgrade. Okay, so there's two paths, if you will, two triggering events that can cause an upgrade to be considered. Obviously the reliability upgrade, since it was triggered by reliability criteria, and the analysis that's done is to pick the lowest cost transmission solution that solves the problem, then it was already triggered then, so there is no analysis to say, do I do an economic cost benefit to see if it needs to be triggered, because it was already needed for reliability. When a line's not needed for reliability, but there's an economic trigger, then the justification for it's the economic cost benefit analysis. So I don't think they're I don't think that's a disparate as much as two different reasons for justifying an upgrade.
Well, let's take my favorite project.
Okay.
And you know very well, I think, what it is, and that is at the AP South interface. Are you familiar with this commission's letter to the president of PJM in September regarding that project?
Not intimately familiar, but I've read it, yes.
Do you know what the status of that project is and approval of it?
My understanding is the project had already been moved as far up in the queue, meaning it already had queue position as far as it needed to go, meaning even if there was no additional queue position that it needed to move up because it was already up there, up at the front. But I got to be honest, I am not in the planning group, so I don't have intimate knowledge of that specific situation. I do have some knowledge, but I'm not the...
Well, the last I heard of this is we received word back from PJM that even though this merchant project was first in the queue, it was not going to be approved because it would harm the financial transmission rights of existing entities. But if it was going to be approved, it was going to take 2 years to put a capacitor in at a substation in rural Virginia. So if you did know about this, and you did tell me that it was going to go forward, I was going to ask you why it was going to take 2 years to put a capacitor bank in when it was going to take 2 years to put an entire 40-mile upgrade to the transmission system. Why do I do this? The reason I've taken an interest in this, and my colleagues as well, is because PJM itself has determined that the AP South interface in Virginia is the biggest source of congestion costs in PJM. And in fact, the Charles River Associates filed in FERC's scarcity pricing proceeding that a reactive power upgrade at AP South would reduce congestion costs by $447 million a year. And I think about $150 million of that a year is being paid by Pennsylvania ratepayers. So if this project, for some reason, is approved, it would save customers in Pennsylvania $150 million a year. And if it has been approved, as it would appear it should be, rather than waiting 3 years for Allegheny Energy to get around to doing it, it would cost Pennsylvania ratepayers $1 billion in the next 2 years waiting for this congestion fix to happen. I think it would be irresponsible for this commission not to pressure PJM for an answer on why this can't be done and why the incumbent transmission owners that have the FTR rights are being given preference over the first